known for drugs, gangs, crime. Not the sort of place a housewife from the suburbs is likely to visit.
She shrugs helplessly and says in a small voice, I'm sorry. Her husband reaches out and squeezes her hand. Fleming hands her a piece of paper. What's this? She asks nervously.
I'm afraid it's a ticket for reckless driving, which is a very serious offense in New York.
She looks at it and bites her lip.
Do I need to get a lawyer?
She asks uncertainly.
Fleming says, That would be a good idea. It's considered a crime. If convicted, you will have a criminal record and might have to do some jail time.
He sees the shock register on her face. Tom Krupp looks as if he's going to be sick. Fleming glances at Curtin, and the two of them nod goodbye and leave the room. Dr. Fulton follows Fleming and Curtin out. As hectic as his life as an emergency physician is, he's had enough time to wonder what his patient was doing racing red lights in the worst part of the city. She seems like a nice woman. Educated, well-spoken. Not the kind you'd expect to do that kind of thing. Clearly, her husband is at a loss, too. He looks at the officers walking away from him down the hall. Two solid figures in black uniforms standing out among a sea of the nurse's pastels. He wonders briefly if he should summon them back. But the moment has passed, and he lets them go. Karen Krupp had been disoriented when they brought her in 2 nights ago, slipping in and out of consciousness. She hadn't seemed to know who she was, hadn't been able to give them her own name. She'd been agitated, and kept repeating something. He thinks it was a man's name. He can't remember what it was. It had been a crazy night in the ER, but he's pretty sure it wasn't Tom. It's been bothering him. Maybe one of the nurses will remember. He doesn't think she's faking the amnesia. He suspects she wants to know what happened that night as much as her husband does. In the evening, it's now almost 48 hours since the accident, Tom leaves the hospital and makes his way to his car at the far end of the parking lot. Karen had seemed distracted and upset during his time with her. The visit from the police officers earlier in the day has them both worried. The thought of Karen ending up with a criminal record, the thought of her possibly going to jail, even if only briefly. He's been Googling reckless driving in New York. He can't bear to think about it. He takes a deep breath. Perhaps they will be lenient. He has to be strong. He tries to put the police charges out of his mind for now. As he drives home, Tom thinks about Karen and about their life together. They'd been so happy, so settled. And now this. When they met, she was temping at his firm, where he's an accountant. There had been an immediate attraction. He could hardly wait for her 2-week assignment to be over so that he could ask her out. Still, he was wary, because he'd misjudged before. So he promised himself he would take his time getting to know her. That seemed to suit her as well. She was reserved in the beginning. He thought perhaps she'd misjudged before, too. But she wasn't like some other women he'd known. She didn't play games. She didn't mess with his head. There was nothing about her to set off alarm bells. There never has been. There has to be a reason for what she's done. She must have been lured there by someone under false pretenses. She will get her memory back, and then she'll be able to explain everything. He can tell Karen's scared. He's scared, too. He parks the car in the driveway and walks heavily up the front steps. Once inside, he looks around the house wearily. The place is a bit of a mess. There are dirty dishes in the kitchen, in the sink, on the table. He'd been grabbing a bite at odd times, going back and forth to the hospital. He'd better clean up. He can't have Karen coming home to a messy house. She would hate that. He starts in the living room, tidying up, putting things away, bringing dirty coffee cups to the kitchen. He runs a vacuum over the large area rug, cleans the glass-topped coffee table with glass cleaner and paper towels. Next, he tackles the kitchen. He fills the dishwasher, wipes down the counters, and runs hot water and dish soap into the sink to wash the glass coffee carafe by hand. He searches for the rubber gloves that Karen uses to wash the dishes, but can't find them. He plunges his hands into the hot, soapy water. He wants Karen to focus on getting well when she comes home, not worrying about the house. Karen's alone when Dr. Fulton stops in for the last time before he leaves that night. It's late, the ward is quiet, and Karen is drowsy. The doctor sits down in the empty chair by her bed and says, hesitantly, "There's something I wanted to mention." She sees the uncertainty in his eyes and feels her body tense. "When they brought you in, you were very disoriented," he begins, "saying things." She's anxious now and wide awake. "You kept saying someone's name over and over. Do you remember that?" She goes completely still. "No." "I couldn't remember, but one of the nurses told me you kept mentioning someone called Robert. Does that name mean anything to you?" He looks at her curiously. Her heart is racing now. She slowly shakes her head back and forth, pursing her lips as if thinking hard. "No," she says. "I don't know anyone by that name." "Okay," Dr. Fulton says, standing up again. "Thought it was worth a try." "I'm sure it doesn't mean anything," Karen says. She waits until the doctor is almost at the door, and then adds, at the last moment, "I don't think you need to mention it to my husband." He turns and looks at her. Their eyes lock for a moment. Then he gives one short nod and leaves the room. Chapter 7. Tom's barely out of the shower the next morning when the doorbell rings. He's thrown on jeans and a t-shirt, and his hair is still wet, but combed. He's leaving for the hospital shortly. Another day out of the office. He's barefoot, and has just put a pot of coffee on. Tom can't imagine who would be at his front door this early. It's not even 8 o'clock. He pads over and peers out the door's window. Officer Fleming is standing on the porch. The sight of Fleming standing outside immediately irritates him. Tom has enough to deal with already, and he doesn't know any more than he did yesterday. He can't help the cops. Why the hell doesn't Fleming just go away and leave them alone until Karen's memory comes back? He opens the door. You can't leave a uniformed cop standing on your doorstep. "Good morning," Fleming says. Tom stares back at him, unsure of what to do. He remembers how kind Fleming was to him the first time he came to Tom's house, with the terrible news of Karen's accident. "May I come in?" Fleming asks at last. He's professional and respectful, just as he was that night. He has a quiet, relaxed air about him. He's not threatening. He seems like someone who would want to give you a hand. Tom nods and opens the door. The house is full of the smell of brewing coffee. He supposes he'd better offer him some. "Coffee?" he asks. "Sure," Fleming says. "That would be great." Tom heads to the spacious kitchen at the back of the house, the cop following him across the hardwood floor. Tom can feel Fleming watching him while he pours them each a cup. He turns around, puts the mugs on the table, and grabs the milk and sugar. The two of them sit down at the kitchen table. "What can I do for you?" Tom asks. He feels awkward, and he's not completely able to keep the irritation out of his voice. Fleming helps himself to milk and sugar and stirs his coffee thoughtfully. "You were there when we spoke to your wife yesterday about the accident," Fleming reminds him. "Yes?" You understand why we had to press charges. Yes, Tom says, his voice sharp. He exhales and adds sincerely, I'm just glad no one else was hurt. There's a long, heavy silence as Tom ponders just how bad it could have been. Karen might have killed someone. What a horror that would be to live with. That's the sort of thing you never get over. Tom tries to tell himself how lucky they are. Suddenly, Tom wants to talk. He doesn't know why he's telling this police officer, a virtual stranger, this, but he can't seem to stop himself. She's my wife. I love her. The cop looks back at him sympathetically. But I have questions, too, Tom says recklessly. The same questions as you. What the hell was she doing down there, driving crazy like that? That's not my wife. My wife doesn't do things like that. Tom pushes his chair back and gets up. He takes his cup to the counter and refills it, trying to regain his self-control. That's why I'm here, Fleming says, watching him closely. I wanted to see if you'd thought of anything, remembered anything that might shed some light on the circumstances around her accident. Sounds like you haven't. No. Tom stares moodily at the floor. The officer pauses for a moment before asking his next question. How is your marriage? Fleming asks quietly. My marriage? Tom says, looking up sharply. This is the second time Fleming has asked him about it. Why do you ask? You made a 911 call that night that she was missing. Because I didn't know where she was. Fleming says, his expression neutral, Your wife seems to have been running from something. I have to ask, was she running from you? What? No! How could you even ask that? I love her! Tom shakes his head. We haven't been married long. Our second anniversary is coming up soon. We're very happy. He hesitates. We were thinking of starting a family. Then he realizes he's just spoken in the past tense. Okay, Fleming says, making an appeasing gesture with both hands. I had to ask. Sure, Tom says. He wants Fleming to leave. What about your wife's life before she met you? Has she ever been married before? No. Tom sets his mug down on the counter behind him and crosses his arms. She ever been in trouble with the law? No, of course not, Tom says dismissively. But even he can see that, given the circumstances, it's not such a ridiculous question. What about you? No, I haven't been in trouble with the law either. I'm sure you can check us both out. I'm a chartered accountant. She's a bookkeeper. We're rather dull. I wonder. Fleming hesitates, as if he's not sure he should say it. What? I wonder if she might be in some kind of danger, Fleming says carefully. What? Tom says, startled. Like I said, she was driving like she was trying to get away from something, as if she were frightened. A calm person doesn't drive like that. Tom has no answer to that. He stares at Fleming and bites at his lower lip. Fleming tilts his head to one side and says, Would you like me to help you look around the house? Tom regards Fleming uneasily. Why? To see if we can find anything that might shed some light. Tom freezes. He doesn't know how to answer. Normal Tom, before all this happened, would have said, sure, let's take a look. But this is post-accident Tom, who doesn't know what his wife was up to when she fled their house and crashed her car. What if there's something she's hiding? Something the police shouldn't find? Fleming is watching him, waiting to see what he will do. Bridget is having her morning coffee, sunlight streaming in and falling in a slant across the carpet. Bob has already left for work, slipping away with a peck on the cheek. Things have not been good between her and Bob for some time. Mostly, he stays away, busy at work. He's the owner of Crookshank Funeral Homes. But when he's home, when he thinks she isn't looking, he watches her, as if he's worried about her, about what she's thinking, about what she might do. But he doesn't genuinely care how she is, Bridget tells herself. He stopped truly caring a while ago. Now he only cares about how her actions might affect him. They don't talk about it anymore, but Bridget knows that their inability, their failure, to have a child together has changed everything. Their infertility has made her depressed and moody, and it has made Bob withdraw from her. She knows she's changed. She used to be fun, even a little reckless. She used to think she could do anything. But now she feels older, more subdued, less attractive, although she is only 32. Bridget saw the uniformed police officer arrive in his cruiser a few minutes ago, right after Bob left. She wonders what the cop is doing at the Krupps. Tom is still home. His car is in the driveway. She lives so much in her head these days. She knows it isn't good for her, but she has no interest in finding a new job and adjusting her expectations, as Bob encourages her to do. She has a lot of time to think about things. She remembers when Karen first moved in. Tom had been single when he bought the house, the only single man in a neighborhood full of families. How bitter Bridget feels. She and Bob had chosen this particular suburb as the perfect place for children. Children they will never have. Then Tom started dating Karen. Once they were married, Karen had made the place her own. Very quickly, Karen had made the place her own. Painting, decorating, landscaping. Bridget watched the transformation take place. There's no question Karen has a good eye. Right from the beginning, before Tom and Karen were even married, Bridget made a point of welcoming Karen to the neighborhood. Bridget was as friendly as it was possible to be. Karen had seemed reserved at first, but quickly began to accept her friendship, as if she were starved for female companionship. Which Bridget supposed she was, having moved recently from out of state, not knowing anyone. They began to spend more and more time together. Karen genuinely seemed to value her as a friend, even if she wasn't quite comfortable sharing confidences. Bridget learned that Karen had been temping at Tom's firm and that she was looking for permanent employment. Bridget was the one who got her the spot as bookkeeper at Crookshank Funeral Homes. It's Bridget who's now making sure that Karen's job is held open for her for as long as she may need. They're relying on a temp in the meantime. No one could accuse her of not being a good friend. Chapter 8. Tom drives Karen home from the hospital in the early evening. It's been 3 days since she had the accident. He drives slowly, carefully, avoiding potholes and sudden stops as she watches out the window. She's grateful. She glances at Tom's profile as he drives. She can tell that he's tense by the set of his jaw, although he's trying to pretend that everything's fine. They finally arrive at their little street, and Tom pulls into the driveway at 24 Dogwood Drive. It's good to be out of the hospital and home again. She loves that trees have had time to grow here. There's none of that crowding you find in the newer, less expensive suburbs, where houses are crammed so closely together, a measly patch of grass for a lawn. She loves the spaciousness here, the green. She's proud of her garden, bursting now with big pink hydrangeas. The two of them sit quietly for a minute, listening to the ticking of the cooling engine. Tom puts his hand on top of hers, briefly. Then she slowly gets out of the car. Once inside the house, she's turning to close the door behind her when Tom tosses his keys on the table by the door. She starts, The loud clatter makes her feel a slice of pain in her temples and a sudden sensation of vertigo. She closes her eyes briefly, sways a little, her hand on the wall.
Sorry. Are you okay? Tom asks, contrite. I shouldn't have done that.
I'm okay. Just a little dizzy, she says.
Sharp noises bother her, as do bright lights and sudden movements. Her brain does need time to recover. After a moment, she walks into the living room, appreciating the soothing pale gray and white colors and the uncluttered decor. The carefully chosen white sofa faces a modern marble fireplace with a smooth, unfussy exterior. In front of the sofa is a large, square, glass-topped coffee table, with her collection of Elle decor and art and antiques stored on the shelf beneath it. Above the fireplace is an enormous mirror, and on the mantelpiece there are framed photographs of the two of them, Tom and her. Matching gray chairs face the sofa, with plump pillows in soothing pale pinks and greens. The entire space is light and clean and airy, and completely familiar to her. It's as if the last few days had never happened. She moves slowly to the oversized picture window at the front of the room and looks out. The houses across the way look perfectly benign. At last she turns away and follows Tom into the kitchen.
I cleaned up, Tom says, smiling.
Everything gleams. The sink, the taps, the countertop, the stainless steel appliances. Even the dark hardwood floor is shiny.
You've done a great job, she says appreciatively, smiling back at him.
She glances out the sliding glass doors into the backyard. Then, feeling thirsty, she goes over to the cupboard and reaches in for a glass to get herself a drink of water. She turns on the tap and looks down at the sink and quickly grabs the counter to steady herself.
I think I'd like to lie down, she says suddenly.
Of course, Tom says.
He takes the glass from her and fills it from the tap. Karen follows Tom upstairs. The bedroom is also light and airy, with lots of windows across the back. There's a novel on her bedside table, and more books on the floor beside the bed. She'd signed them out of the library recently. She'd especially been looking forward to reading the new Kate Atkinson, but she can't read much now until her concussion is better. Doctor's orders. Tom is watching her. She glances at her dresser. On top of it, there's a mirrored tray holding perfume bottles. Beside that is her jewelry box. Her regular jewelry she's wearing again. Her diamond engagement ring and matching wedding band, and the necklace Tom bought her for their first anniversary. Karen sees herself in the familiar mirror above her dresser, still battered and bruised. She remembers how frightened she'd been. All those times she'd come home and found things slightly out of place, subtle signs that someone had been going through her things. It had scared her, and Tom knew nothing about it. She'd been hiding an awful lot from the man she loves. And she's been so anxious, worried that Dr. Fulton would share what she'd said in emergency with Tom, with the police. If only she could remember what happened that night. She feels as if she's blind, trying to navigate dangers she can't see. All at once, she's very tired. Tom says soothingly, "Why don't you rest, and I'll make supper." She nods. She doesn't want to make supper. She doesn't want to do anything but curl into a ball under the covers and hide from the world. He says carefully,
"Some of your friends have been asking when they can come visit."
"I'm not ready to see anyone just yet, except for Bridget."
She's been grateful for Bridget, but she doesn't want to see anyone else. She doesn't want to answer their questions.
"I told them that. They want to come anyway."
"Not yet."
He nods. "I'm sure they'll understand.
It can wait. You're supposed to have quiet anyway."
He looks at her, concerned.
"How do you feel?"
She wants to say terrified. Instead, she says, with a faint smile, glad to be home.
Tom lights the grill, marinates a steak, and quickly throws together a small salad and garlic bread. It's a relief to have Karen back home again. But there's still the elephant in the room. The accident. And what had led up to it. He wants to trust her. That police officer, Fleming, had wanted to look through the house this morning. Tom remembers how taken aback he'd been when the cop had suggested it. The first thing Tom thought was, what is he looking for? Then, what if he finds something? Something bad? He told the cop no. After, he watched from behind the curtains as the cop took a long, lingering look at the house and got back into his cruiser and drove away. Then Tom had done two things. He'd searched online for a local criminal lawyer and made an appointment, and then he'd torn the house apart. It had taken the better part of the day, with a break to visit Karen in the hospital. The kitchen had taken the longest. He felt through all the cereal boxes, the bags of flour, rice, sugar, anything that wasn't sealed. He took everything out of every cupboard and drawer and looked all the way in the back. He felt unseen surfaces for anything that might be affixed to them. He looked at the top shelves of closets, under the rugs and mattresses, inside suitcases and seldom-worn boots and shoes. He went down to the basement, breathing in the musty air and waiting for his eyes to adjust to the dimmer light. There wasn't much down there, just the laundry room and a few boxes of junk. They used it mostly for storage. He went through everything. He even looked behind the furnace. Finally, he went through the garage. The whole time he was searching, he was in a strange state of disbelief about himself and his situation. What the hell was he doing? What was he looking for? He found nothing. Nothing at all. He felt foolish, frustrated, and ashamed. And relieved. When he was finished, he tidied everything up again the way it was before, so that Karen wouldn't know what he'd done. And then he'd gone to pick her up at the hospital. When the steak is done, Tom carries it inside and runs upstairs to tell Karen that supper's ready. They settle in at the kitchen table to eat. Tom offers her red wine, but she shakes her head gently. "Oh, right," he says. "I forgot. No alcohol while you're on pain meds." He puts the wine aside and gets them sparkling water instead. Tom looks at his wife across the table, her short brown hair cut in a pixie, bangs falling across her forehead, the lopsided, rueful half-smile on her face. If it weren't for the bruising, he could almost believe that nothing has changed. It's almost like it used to be. But it's nothing like it used to be. Karen wakes very early in the morning, before first light. She gets up quietly and pulls on a robe. She closes the door behind her and makes her way downstairs to the kitchen. She knows she won't be going back to sleep. She puts on a pot of coffee and stands looking out with her arms folded, comforted by the familiar sound and smell of the coffee brewing, waiting for it to finish. As dawn breaks, there's a light mist rising from the back lawn. She stands looking out the glass doors for a long time, trying desperately to remember. She feels as if her life might depend on it. Chapter 9.
"Hey,"
Tom says, quietly entering the kitchen and seeing Karen at the kitchen table with a cup in front of her. It looks like her coffee is long gone cold. He wonders how long she's been up. She raises her eyes to meet his.
"Good morning."
She looks charmingly disheveled in her robe. He feels so grateful to have her here, to have her in his life at all, when he'd been so afraid of losing her the night of the accident. But it feels fragile, too.
like they're walking on glass.
How did you sleep?
Not great, she admits. You want some coffee?
Sure.
She gets up and kisses him on the mouth, exactly the way she used to. She pulls away from him, leaving his head spinning. She pours him a cup of coffee and starts to make breakfast.
No, you sit down. Let me do that, Tom tells her firmly.
He begins toasting bagels and cracking eggs into a frying pan.
I've got to start going back into the office again soon, he says apologetically. I wish I could stay home with you, but it's really busy at work right now.
She says, no, that's okay, really. I'm fine. I don't need you to be looking after me all the time. I promise I'll take it easy. She smiles at him reassuringly. Tom has something else he needs to tell her. There's no avoiding it.
There's one other thing.
He pauses, looking up from the frying pan at her. What?
I made an appointment for us to see a lawyer.
He sees the sudden flicker of fear in her eyes. She bites worriedly at her lower lip. When?
This morning, at 10.
She slides her eyes away. Oh, so soon?
It's a serious charge, Karen, he says.
I know that. You don't have to tell me,
she snaps.
Suddenly, they are both tense. Tom wishes they didn't have to see a lawyer, that there had never been an accident, that she'd never run out of the house that night. He feels a flash of anger at her. But what's done is done, and now they have to deal with it as best they can. He realizes he's clenching his jaw and tries to relax. He keeps his feelings to himself. The law firm is in a high-rise office building not far from their house. Karen has been silent for the short drive. Tom doesn't say much either. It's already hot, but there's nowhere to park out of the sun. When they head inside, the cool, air-conditioned building is a relief. They take the elevator to the 6th floor. When they get there, the waiting room is empty. Tom watches Karen out of the corner of his eye. She doesn't say anything, doesn't reach for any of the magazines on the low table. She sits tightly in her chair, waiting. It doesn't take long.
Mr. and Mrs. Krupp, you can go in now, the receptionist says, and leads them to an office door that she opens for them, then closes behind her.
Inside, the office looks like the office of any other lawyer, not unlike that of the real estate attorney Tom used to purchase the house on Dogwood Drive before he met Karen. There's an enormous desk, with files neatly stacked all over it. Behind the desk, the lawyer, Jack Calvin, a man with curly salt-and-pepper hair whom Tom judges to be in his mid-40s, rises to shake hands with each of them, then gestures for them to sit.
"What can I do for you?" he asks.
The lawyer looks at the two of them curiously. There's a keen intelligence behind his sharp eyes. Tom can almost see him thinking, "What is this nice couple doing here in my office?"
"I called yesterday, about the charge relating to my wife's recent traffic accident," Tom says when Karen remains silent.
Being in a criminal lawyer's office seems to have cowed her.
"Refresh me," the man says, not unkindly. "I get a lot of traffic offenses. My bread and butter. Especially DWIs. Is that what we have here?"
He flashes a quick appraising glance at Karen.
"No," Tom says, and begins to explain about the accident. "There was no alcohol involved at all. But unfortunately, she was going over the speed limit and..."
The lawyer cuts him off.
"Sorry. Maybe let her tell me what happened, in her own words."
Tom glances at Karen, who seems to tense up. The lawyer watches her expectantly. When neither Tom nor Karen says anything for a moment, the lawyer glances back and forth between them and asks,
"Is there a problem?"
"Yes," Karen says, finally speaking. "I don't remember the accident. I don't remember anything about it." She frowns apologetically.
"Really?"
Calvin says. I can't remember anything about that entire evening, she says. It's just a blank.
It's true, Tom says. She's got a severe concussion. She only came home from the hospital yesterday.
The lawyer looks at them, as if amazed.
Is this for real? Or is this a defense you're trying on? Because you don't need to do that. I'm your lawyer. Leave the defense to me.
This is not something we're trying on, Tom says firmly. She has amnesia. But the doctors are pretty sure it's temporary and that she'll get her memory back.
He looks at Karen, sitting pale beside him. She's getting that pinched look that, since the accident, signals the onset of a pounding headache.
I see, the lawyer says.
He looks at Karen curiously. Tom hands him the ticket they got from the police. Calvin reads it over quickly. He looks up.
Pretty sketchy part of town for a woman like you, he says, looking at Karen.
She sits perfectly still and straight. The lawyer turns to Tom.
What was she doing there?
Tom says,
I don't know.
You don't know,
the lawyer repeats. He studies both of them as if he doesn't know what to think. There's a long silence. Finally, he says,
This is pretty serious. Reckless driving. You don't want to mess around.
He thinks for a minute.
I tell you what. I will need a retainer today, and then I'm going to delay the court appearance until she remembers what she was doing there and why she was driving like that. Because there may be a perfectly good reason for it, or at least a mitigating one. And if there isn't, we need to know that too.
Tom glances at his wife, but she's now looking down at her lap. He reaches for his checkbook.
If you do remember anything, the lawyer says, directing his comment to Karen, please write it all down so that when we meet next time, it's fresh in your mind.
He adds,
and call me when you do.
Karen nods. Okay.
Or perhaps you'd like to see me without your husband present.
She shoots a sharp look at Calvin. She shakes her head and says, Of course not. I have nothing to hide from my husband. Tom watches her carefully. Does she mean it? They settle the retainer, and as they get up to leave, Calvin asks Karen,
You don't have a record, do you?
She turns and answers him, looking him right in the eye. No. The lawyer looks back at her, and something in his appraising eye worries Tom. He realizes that the lawyer doesn't believe her. He doesn't believe her at all. On the drive home from the lawyer's office, the air is thick with the tension of unanswered questions. Tom used to love driving with Karen. Some of his happiest memories are of them together in this car, driving out to the country for a weekend tryst, bags packed in the back seat, her head tilted back, laughing. It's almost a relief when Tom's cell phone rings. He takes the call. Then he turns to her, apologetically.
I need to go into the office for a bit.
Of course.
You okay?
I have a headache. She closes her eyes and rests her head against the back of the seat. Tom drops her off at home. He leans over and kisses her before she gets out of the car.
Take it easy. Have a nap.
I'll try to be home early. She gets out of the car and waves at him, squinting in the sun as he backs out of the driveway. He waves back and drives away down the street, worrying about what the future holds, wondering about what secrets his wife might be keeping. Chapter 10. Once he's gone, Karen turns toward the house and lets herself in. The appointment with the lawyer has unnerved her. He obviously thought she was lying. She presses her fingers to her tired eyes. She makes her way to the kitchen and opens the freezer and grabs the ice pack they sent home with her from the hospital. She's been using it off and on for the swelling on her face. Now she puts it to her forehead. The cold feels good. She sits down at the kitchen table with her eyes closed and holds the ice pack to her head, moving it around slowly, trying to relieve the thudding pain. It's such a hot day, sweltering. She can feel herself perspiring in her blouse, even with the air conditioning on. Maybe she should turn it up. As the pain in her head abates slightly, she opens her eyes. She stares at the kitchen counter, the one she had replaced when she moved in. She still loves looking at it, its smooth, glossy black surface, flecked with silver. But now what she sees is an empty glass beside the sink. She stares at the glass, then glances quickly around the kitchen, but nothing else looks other than it should. The glass on the counter by the sink wasn't there when they left this morning for the lawyer's office. She's certain of it. Because before they left, she and Tom, mostly Tom, had tidied up the kitchen and put the breakfast dishes in the dishwasher and wiped down the counters. She hates when dishes are left out on the counter. She's a bit of a neat freak. And she knows that she had a last look in the kitchen before joining Tom at the front door and leaving to see the lawyer, because she came back to make sure the sliding glass doors were locked. She always checks that the doors are locked, which is why it was so unnerving when Tom told her she hadn't locked the doors behind her on the night of the accident, or turned off the lights, or taken her purse. If only she could remember. She picks up the glass tentatively, looks inside, holds it to her nose, and sniffs. It's empty now, but there was water in it, she's sure. As if someone had come in and helped himself to a glass of tap water from the sink before heading back out into the heat. Her head is pounding, and she suddenly feels dizzy. She tries to grab the counter, and clumsily drops the glass. It shatters loudly on the floor. She stares down at the broken glass by her feet, breathing in gasps, her entire body trembling. Then she turns quickly and runs to the living room and grabs the phone. She hits the speed dial for Bridget's number. "Bridget," she says, when Bridget answers. "Can you come over? Hurry!" She doesn't even try to tamp down the fear and panic she's feeling. She just wants Bridget here with her, right away. She doesn't want to be alone in the house. "Sure, I'll be right there," Bridget says. Karen stands impatiently outside on the front porch. Within seconds, she sees Bridget rush out of her own door and cross the street. Thank God for Bridget.
"Jesus, Karen, what is it?"
Bridget says.
"You're white as a sheet."
"Someone's been in the house," Karen says.
"What?"
Bridget looks taken aback.
"What do you mean?"
Karen urges her inside.
"Someone was in here while Tom and I were out this morning. I just got back. When I went into the kitchen..."
She can't finish what she's saying.
"Did you see someone? Was there someone in the kitchen?"
Bridget asks. Karen shakes her head.
"No."
She's calmer now that Bridget is here. How fortunate she is to have such a good friend right across the street. Karen knows that whatever kind of trouble she might be in, Bridget would drop everything and race to her side. She wishes she could tell her why she's so frightened. But she can't tell her best friend, or her husband, the truth. She watches Bridget approach the kitchen and stop just inside the doorway, silently looking around. After a moment, she comes quietly back to Karen's side.
"Karen, what happened?"
"I got home and went into the kitchen. There was an empty glass on the counter. It wasn't there when we left this morning. Someone put it there, and it wasn't me or Tom."
"Are you sure?"
Bridget asks.
"Of course I'm sure. Do you think I'd be this upset if I wasn't sure?"
Bridget looks back at her with concern. Then she glances toward the kitchen and back at Karen.
"How did the glass get broken?"
"I picked it up to look at it, and then I got dizzy, and I dropped it."
Bridget looks at her uneasily.
"Maybe we should call Tom."
Tom drives home as fast as he reasonably can, his mind racing. When he arrives, he gets out of his car in a rush and sprints up the steps to the front door. He bursts into the living room and sees Karen lying down on the sofa with the ice pack on her forehead, Bridget standing nearby.
"Karen, honey, are you all right? What happened?"
She struggles to sit up. She hands the ice pack to Bridget, who automatically takes it from her to put back in the freezer.
"I don't know," she says. "I came home and found a glass on the counter. I'm sure it wasn't there when we left this morning. I thought someone had been in the house."
Tom moves toward the kitchen, stopping outside the doorway when he sees the mess of broken glass. He catches Bridget's eye as she closes the freezer door and walks cautiously around the glittering shards. Karen comes up and stands beside him.
"I dropped the glass," she says.
Tom looks at her with concern.
"Are you sure it wasn't there before?"
"It could have been," Tom says. He tries to recall if he'd helped himself to a glass of water that morning and left the glass out on the counter, but he can't remember. He's got so much on his mind, details like this are slipping away from him.
"I don't know," she says, shaking her head. "I was so sure. I took a last look in here before we left, to check that the back doors were locked. I thought everything was put away."
"Come, sit down," Tom says, taking her back to the sofa, while Bridget starts sweeping up the broken glass.
He leaves Karen on the sofa and searches the entire house. Nothing is missing. Nothing is out of place as far as he can tell. When he returns to the living room, Bridget is sitting in one of the armchairs across from Karen. She's dressed for the heat, in cotton capris and a tank top, her long brown hair flowing to her shoulders. As he watches, she pulls her hair into a knot at the back of her neck. Tom turns to Karen.
"I don't think anyone's been in here," he says gently.
Karen looks at him and then shifts her eyes away.
"What? You think I'm imagining it?"
"No," Tom says calmly. "I don't think you're imagining anything. I think you don't remember clearly whether there was a glass there before or not. We've both been drinking a lot of water in this heat. Either one of us could have left the glass on the counter. I might have. I don't remember."
He reminds her gently, "You're still recovering, Karen. Remember what the doctor said? You could have some problems with short-term memory after the accident for a while, too. Maybe the glass was there before and you don't remember."
"Maybe,"
she says doubtfully. Tom turns to Bridget.
"I'll take it from here," he says. "Thanks for rushing over."
"Anytime," Bridget says. "Yes," Karen says gratefully, as Bridget gets up to leave. "I don't know what I'd do without you, Bridget."
Tom watches Bridget give his wife a gentle hug. Karen hugs her warmly back.
"Thanks for cleaning up the broken glass, too," Tom says.
"No problem." She smiles at Karen. "See you soon."
Bridget heads across the street to her own house, while the two of them stand on the doorstep, watching after her. Tom is standing slightly behind Karen. He's watching Bridget, and he's also watching his wife.
Chapter 11. Detective Rasbach pauses for a moment to take in his surroundings. There's a rundown plaza across the road, with a convenience store, a coin laundry, a dollar store, and not much else still open for business. Even on a sunny summer day like this one, the neighborhood is depressing. In front of him is the scene of the crime, an abandoned restaurant. The building has been boarded up, but someone has pried a couple of boards off the window in the front to look inside. Or maybe they've just fallen off over time. Rasbach walks around the outside of the derelict building to the back. He nods to a couple of tech people and steps inside the yellow crime scene tape. He enters the restaurant through the grimy back door, which hadn't been boarded up like the front. At least, if it had, it wasn't any longer. Anybody could get in or out. The first thing that hits him is the smell. He tries to ignore it. There's an old-fashioned dining counter to his left, but there are no tables or chairs. The place has been stripped clean. Even the overhead lights are missing. But there is an old couch up against the wall with some empty beer cans on the floor around it. There's some sunlight filtering in from the windows where the boards have fallen away, but most of the light is coming from lamps put in place by the forensics team. The dirty linoleum floor is cracked, the walls are dark and stained with nicotine, and there's a dead man lying on the floor. The smell is pretty bad. That's what happens when a body isn't discovered for a few days in the heat of the summer. This one is pretty ripe. Razbok stands perfectly still in the middle of the reeking restaurant, in his smart, expensive suit, thinking he will have to have it dry cleaned, and pulls a pair of latex gloves out of his pocket.
"Someone called it in. Didn't leave a name,"
the uniformed officer beside him says. The detective nods tiredly. He moves toward the bloody, buzzing mess on the floor. He stands for several minutes looking down at the body, studying it. He's a dark-haired man, probably mid-to-late 30s, dressed in expensive-looking black trousers and an equally expensive-looking dress shirt, now crusted in dried, dark blood and covered with flies. The victim had taken a couple of shots to the face, another to the chest. His shoes are missing, revealing rather stylish socks. No belt, either.
"Any sign of the weapon?"
Razbok asks a technician standing on the other side of the body, also looking down thoughtfully at the corpse.
"No, not yet."
Razbok leans over the body carefully, trying not to breathe, noting the pale shadow around the finger where a ring has recently been removed, and a similar pale band around the wrist where a watch had once been. He'd been robbed, but this was not primarily a robbery, Razbok thinks. What had the man been doing here? He didn't belong here, in this neighborhood. This looks more like an execution. Except he'd been shot in the face and chest, rather than in the back of the head. The body looks like it's been dead for at least a couple of days, maybe longer. The face is discolored and bloated.
"Do we know who he is?"
"No, he doesn't have any ID on him. In fact, he doesn't have anything on him, except his clothes."
"Any witnesses?"
Razbok asks, already knowing the answer.
"Nada. At least so far."
"Okay."
Razbok sighs deeply. The body would be removed soon and sent to the medical examiner to be autopsied. They'd get fingerprints from the body and see if there was anything matching them on file. If they couldn't ID him through the prints, they'd have to go through missing persons, which would be tedious, but much of police work is tedious. It's often the tedious work that pays off. They'll keep looking for the murder weapon. Probably a .38 caliber handgun, by the looks of it. Odds are the shooter disposed of it far away from the scene, or someone else picked it up and is keeping quiet. Given the neighborhood, Razbok's not surprised that the belt and shoes were taken, as well as the victim's wallet and jewelry, and no doubt his cell phone as well. By the time they've finished with the body and completed a wider sweep of the area, all they've found is a pair of pink rubber gloves with a floral print near the elbows, discarded in a small parking lot a short distance away. Razbok doesn't think they have anything to do with the victim in the restaurant, but he has them bagged anyway. You just never know. Razbok and another detective, Jennings, along with a couple of uniformed officers, spend the evening going door to door in the area, looking for witnesses. Not surprisingly, they come up empty-handed. Dr. Pereira, the medical examiner, is expecting them the next morning.
"Hello, detectives,"
he says, obviously pleased to see them. Razbok knows the ME enjoys it when the detectives come to visit. Razbok marvels at the fact that even after almost 20 years, the depressing nature of the doctor's job doesn't ever seem to get him down. Stabbings, gunshots, drownings, car accidents. Nothing seems to bother the sanguine and invariably social Dr. Periera. He holds out a bowl of wrapped mint candies. They help with the smell. Both detectives take one. The wrappers crinkle as they unwrap the mints. Dr. Periera holds his hand out for the wrappers and drops them in the trash can.
What can you tell us?
Rasbach asks as they stand around the long steel table looking down at the cadaver resting upon it. Rasbach is grateful that Jennings has always had a strong stomach, like him. Jennings looks keen and curious, and not at all bothered by the butchery on the table, the mint candy making a bulge in his cheek.
The body's intact, Dr. Periera begins cheerfully. Caucasian male, late 30s, good health. The first shot went into the chest, the second into the cheek, but it was the third shot, which went right into the brain, that killed him. Death was fairly quick. He was shot at close range, from about 6 to 8 feet away, with a 38 caliber handgun.
Rasbach nods.
When did he die, exactly?
He asks. Dr. Periera turns to Rasbach.
I know how much you guys love to pin down the time of death, and I do my best, I really do. But if you send me a corpse that's been sitting idle for a few days, it affects my ability to be accurate, you understand.
The detective knows Dr. Periera is a perfectionist. He always qualifies his findings.
I appreciate that, Rasbach says patiently. But I would still prefer your best guess over anyone else's.
The doctor smiles.
I performed the autopsy last night. Based on the state of decomposition and the larvae found in the body, bearing in mind, of course, the very hot weather we've been having, my guess is he died about 4 days before that, give or take a day.
Rasbach calculates.
So, 4 days from last night, that would be the evening of August 13th.
Dr. Periera nods.
But he could have been killed as early as the evening of August 12th, or as late as the evening of August 14th, somewhere in there.
Rasbach looks down at the body on the steel table. If only he could talk. Back at the station, Rasbach chooses one of the large meeting rooms for their ad hoc command post and addresses the team he's cobbled together. He and Jennings are the detectives on this, and he has chosen several uniformed officers from the patrol division to assist.
We still don't know who this guy is, Rasbach says. We have no match on his prints anywhere, against known missing persons or on any other databases. Let's start circulating a description and photos to law enforcement agencies and the media. See if we can find out who he is. He might still be recognizable to somebody.
Rasbach decides to check all police records for the 48-hour period between the evenings of August 12th and August 14th. He's looking for anything out of the ordinary. There isn't much. Nothing shows up but some minor drug busts and a couple of car accidents. One of the car accidents seemed straightforward enough, a mid-afternoon fender bender. But the other one, a Honda Civic had been speeding, away from the vicinity of the crime scene, and had hit a utility pole at around 8:45 on the evening of August 13th. The hairs on the back of Rasbach's neck tingle when he sees it. Chapter 12.
What can we do for you?
Fleming asks Rasbach, sipping coffee out of a mug.
Not every day a homicide detective comes to our end of the building.
Rasbach places the photographs of his murder victim on the desk. Fleming and Curtin both lean forward to look. Curtin shakes his head. Fleming takes his time, looking carefully, but says nothing.
Body wasn't found for several days, Rasbach says. August 17th. At least no one called it in till then. I think it was picked over by locals first. Don't recognize him, Curtin says. I haven't seen him before, either.
Fleming looks at Rasbach.
What's this got to do with us?
He was killed in an abandoned restaurant on Hoffman Street around August 13th, give or take a day.
I understand there was a car accident not far from there on the evening of the 13th.
Fleming and Curtin share a quick glance. Curtin sits up straighter, nodding.
There was.